Since 9/11, what the government is doing is a pretty horrendous thing in the world and here at home.
There's no analyst anywhere of any persuasion who has questioned the ability of the United States.
The signing on is cynical. It's a cover operation. The UN is simply a fig leaf for U.S. aggression in Iraq.
It's a privilege to be alive. It's a privilege to be in this country. It's a privilege to have this radio show. It's a privilege. I find it a privilege to being this life of this African-American woman life, this privilege to say, not in my name.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. In another warning to Saddam Hussein, U.S. officials said today that Iraq must not play games with U.N. weapons inspectors, and they disputed Iraq's claim not to have nuclear, chemical, or biological weapons. Anthony Arnov, editor of Iraq Under Siege, says Saddam Hussein had very little choice but to accept the resolution, and he doubts it will stave off the Bush administration's drive towards war. Arnov suspects the administration will move aggressively to provoke Saddam Hussein into war, and adds President Bush has been long deceiving the American public in his campaign for military attack against Iraq.
I think President Bush is trying to deceive Americans into thinking that Iraq has a connection to the attacks of September 11th and that Iraq poses a serious threat to the United States in order to portray a war, which I think is an offensive war, as a defensive measure, as a war to protect Americans. And the examples of deceit are many, but I'll just give three very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
One, Bush has talked about evidence of ties between Iraq and al-Qaeda, and anyone who's looked at the evidence says that it's not there, that the Bush administration is fabricating that connection. There's also been exaggeration and distortion of the state of Iraq's military capacity, and there are numerous examples of that where Bush has spoken quite confidently about nuclear programs in Iraq and military capacities in Iraq, particularly long-range missile capacities that, you know, the available evidence suggests does not exist. And also, George Bush has lied about the history of the weapons inspections in Iraq. He's referred on several occasions to Iraq kicking out weapons inspectors, referring to 1998, when in fact the United Nations inspection team was withdrawn in anticipation of the U.S. bombing of Iraq in December 1998.
Mm. Now, do you see the mainstream media as being complicit in this scenario to deceive that's being waged, in your opinion, by the Bush administration?
Yeah, I think that largely what has happened is that the media has amplified, has been kind of an echo chamber for the Bush administration's views.
And, you know, I noticed this morning on ABC News, for example, that an analyst was on, an expert, a terrorist expert, that said there's no love lost between Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein. But in the letter that Osama released yesterday, Osama expressed concern for the innocent children of Iraq who will be caught in the crossfire. That struck me as a different portrayal of the relationship between Osama and Saddam Hussein than what the Bush administration had been portraying.
Yeah, there's certainly, I mean, if you look at the broad range of coverage, there's been some useful information. You can even look to the most the papers that editorially most support a war and find information that undermines the administration's case. But the thrust of coverage, you know, as I think has reflected the Bush administration's viewpoint. And it's certainly true. There is no love lost between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. And in fact, the government in Iraq, the Ba'athist Party, is a secular party that has been politically at odds with Islamists for decades, not only in Iraq, but in Syria, and in other countries in the region.
And yet the Bush administration attempts to connect dots between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden. And apparently, it seems as though the American public is not making the connection.
Yeah, I think what's interesting is the New York Times had a poll around a month ago in which they asked people what reason they thought George Bush had for going to war with Iraq. Was it weapons or was it regime change? And 53% said regime change, which is quite interesting. I think it reveals a healthy level of skepticism among the population that even though Bush claims that this is about weapons, people think that this is about changing the government in Iraq and potentially changing the government in other countries.
Did that poll ask how many agreed that the U.S. should be attempting to regime change in Iraq?
It did not, but it did ask another question, which was quite interesting, which was it asked for the first time that I've seen in a poll, would your support for the war go down if there were significant Iraqi casualties? Usually the question is just put in terms of American casualties.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it dropped significantly. It also dropped in the case of American casualties. It also dropped in the case of lack of support from the international community, which is one reason why I think the United States realized that it would be more effective to go through the UN, get a fig leaf of multilateralism. But in reality, I think it's a fig leaf. It's not a genuine multilateralism.
And I wonder if the American public that supports the war, if they believe that there won't be casualties, either Iraqis or Americans.
Yeah, I think the media has done a disservice in not covering the great likelihood of casualties that will be caused by this war, not covering the casualties from the last war in 1991, or the casualties that I think can be linked to the embargo, which has had significant impact on the civilian population, or the casualties linked to the ongoing U.S. and U.K. bombing that has been taking place, which has been largely unreported in the U.S. media.
There was a report released just this week that predicts that there could be at least 250,000 casualties in the first 3 months of the war.
Yeah, it's a very serious, detailed report. It came from a group based in the United Kingdom and also with an office in Australia. And I encourage people to check out the report. It's called Collateral Damage, the Health and Environmental Costs of War on Iraq. And they've done very, serious, rigorous analysis. And I think that the scenario is quite realistic. There's every reason to think that there would be more civilian suffering caused by the war this time than in 1991. It's far more likely that it will target urban areas more heavily than happened in the 1991 Gulf War. And also you're bombing a country that suffered 12 years of sanctions, has suffered bombing, and has not been rebuilt from the last war.
Now, when you say that it's more likely that they'll target urban areas, is that based on information from the Pentagon? Or
well, what's the Pentagon's own scenario is that Saddam Hussein's army, if there's another confrontation, won't be fighting in the desert. They have learned some lessons from 1991. Also, they won't have been engaged in Kuwait, so that they're far more likely, understanding that the agenda of the Bush administration includes regime change, to focus troops in Baghdad, which is a city of 5 million people, densely populated, and the consequences of invasion of Baghdad or aerial bombardment of Baghdad are really horrifying.
Mm-hmm. Also, in that same report, there's discussion about whether or not Saddam Hussein would use what they called human shields, in other words, placing military operations in places like hospitals and schools to try to discourage the Americans from bombing those areas.
Sure. I mean, there's both a pragmatic aspect to that, and then there's a propaganda aspect to that that you have to look at, which is that if this war happens, and I think it's quite likely it will, unfortunately, the United States will claim that any so-called collateral damage its bombs cause were the fault of the Iraqi government. They'll say that any civilians that are anywhere near any military installation were deliberately put there. And we've seen numerous examples of that over the last decade. And in many of those cases, I think any serious analysis would show that that's untrue.
So that's propaganda on the part of the U.S.?
That's propaganda. But there are also, of course, examples where the Iraqi government, acting defensively, may indeed use human shields. But I think we'll have to have an independent analysis of that, and that we can't just trust the judgment of the United States. If you go back to the 1991 Gulf War, the U.S. hit civilian targets that they later claimed were examples of human shields, but reporters who went in on the ground afterwards found evidence that they were clearly identified civilian infrastructure.
And that there were no military sites.
They were not military sites.
Or nearby.
But in a city of, like Baghdad, the question of military sites nearby is quite complicated because the political infrastructure of the Iraqi government is based in the city. So given that the United States has rules of engagement that in the past have allowed targeting of those kinds of political bodies and political infrastructure, they even, if you recall, in the war with Serbia, considered the media to be legitimate targets because the media were deemed to be broadcasting pro-government propaganda, pro-war propaganda.
Anthony Arnov is editor of Iraq Under Siege. Many analysts we've spoken with over the past several days have expressed concern over last Friday's UN approval of the resolution to mandate a new round of weapons inspections in Iraq. But George Lopez, director of policy studies at the University of Notre Dame, disagrees.
Any knowledgeable person in the diplomatic or arms control community, regardless of their political persuasion, knows that effective inspection on the ground in the year 2002 is by leaps and bounds way ahead of the technological potentials that we had in 91 through 97, and still under those conditions, and under conditions of the Iraqis being obstreperous, we were able to eliminate all of the potential and existing framework for the production of nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
We were able to eliminate the vast majority of chemical weapons stocks. We were able to uncover dynamics of not only the history, but real cultures associated with the biological program. We were very, very successful under the most difficult of conditions in 91 through 98. I expect 6 months of serious inspections, armed with the new technology, armed with the strength of this resolution, will be able to render in any objective way.
So you support the resolution?
I not only support the resolution, I support the inspections regime because I know the kind of training and materials that these people bring to bear on this task.
Some critics have said that the resolution, the way it's written, is far too broad, and it's basically going to set up the Iraqi government for failure.
There's still a two-stage process here. There's an outline in the text for the things that Iraq must comply with. In a world that respects the full authority of the United Nations, I would have seen the prior resolutions as sufficient grounds for the inspectors going in. But when the inspection team under Hans Blix thought they could have more direction and more guarantee for accessibility, I think the international community had to respect that. It is clear that people in Washington are interpreting this resolution very differently than some other Security Council members are. There is a two-stage process here. If there's a violation by the Iraqis, that needs to be brought back to the Council. There's not an automatic mechanism, but I'm not surprised to see the Bush people try to argue that. What is clear to me in a technical or human way, the tough stumbling blocks for the Iraqis within the resolution are how to appropriately and fully document by December 8th all the materials you've had and where you might have them. There may be, for example, three dead chemical weapons experts who developed systems in the late 90s who won't be brought around the table to document what they did because they're no longer alive.
And therefore that's a breach?
Well, it's a breach if there's Western intelligence that says, aha, we know you have VX gas in the following two facilities, but the people who are brought around the table to record where the VX gas is don't know that because the people who are in charge of developing on that site are no longer with us. And you know, there's a breach of the spirit of an agreement, and there's a breach of the real letter and intent of an agreement. I believe the conditions exist that the Iraqis can comply with this, and I believe that the most difficult dynamics here are going to not be related to obstreperousness on the part of the Iraqis or a malicious intent to deceive. I think there are going to be matters of interpretation that governments and human factors bring to bear on a situation, especially if you're under time pressure to record fully the bureaucratic process by which you've developed weapon systems. That's the toughest and maybe the most unfair part of the resolution as I see it.
And you mentioned the timetable, the very short timetable.
Yeah, it's very tight.
And the far-reaching requirements here.
Yeah.
Mandates on the part of the resolution, and that does concern you somewhat?
It does concern me. I would have pushed for a slightly longer time frame because receiving this report on January 8th doesn't change the nature of the inspections because the inspectors are going to take 30 to 45 days to gear up anyway. We know that Blix is going in with not only a set of discovery systems that can detect radiation and can detect underground installations that might be building weapons, but he's going to be installing monitoring systems and begin the process of testing air samples. All of that doesn't need a historical documentation, but it seems to me that the U.S. and Britain were adamant about having as rapid a response of intentions and as rapid a response of honest intentions from the Iraqis as they could get, and this is the way they chose to formulate it. This is the part where I feel, as an analyst, this is the part that the French and the Russians and others gave in on.
The president has said over and over again, and I guess he made his most convincing speech to some, in his case before the UN, that peaceful means have already been explored. Obviously, you disagree with that.
There's no analyst anywhere of any persuasion who has questioned the ability of the United States to take out this regime and to bring Iraq to its knees within a short amount of time. The only debatable question is how many Iraqis and how many Americans will be killed in that. And so the burden of proof for whether or not peaceful means have been exhausted probably has to be a pretty serious one when there's no doubt in the minds of any about who would win this war. And I also believe that if you look at the history of this over the last 12 years, this is a security problem that has been owned by the global security community through the Security Council. It's not been an exclusive problem of the province of the U.S. or Britain, although they have chosen to continue to volunteer to be the enforcers of Security Council will. You don't pull up stakes 12 years into it and decide you're going to go it alone. The burden of proof about whether or not full means have been exhausted rests with the international community, not the United States.
George Lopez is Director of Policy Studies at the University of Notre Dame. He also co-authored the recent report from the Earth Freedom Foundation titled Winning Without War, Sensible Security Options for Dealing with Iraq. Peace Watch commentators Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen interpret the UN resolution a bit differently.
A kid glove over a metal fist containing provocative items. That is how the San Francisco Chronicle on November 9th reported the unanimous vote for the United Nations Resolution 1441 on Iraq. The resolution contains many provisions that allow inspections to be carried out in such an aggressive, intrusive manner that Saddam Hussein will never be able to fulfill them, thus triggering a U.S. invasion. Let's look at the criteria.
Well, Maya, you know, when you examined what this U.N. resolution really does, leaving aside the fact that it was preceded by negotiations over who gets the oil, literally divided up the percentages, and the Russians and the French were pleading with the U.S. to cut them in, and on the basis of a tentative promise went along with it. Look at what this U.N. thing does. Iraq has 30 days to provide a complete list of all weapons and research programs and facilities, and they have to itemize all the materials not related to weapon production. That means everything in civilian factories, everything pertaining to medical research. So the outcome of that demand was responded to by Hans Blix, the chief inspector who will head the UN inspection team, who stated that Iraq has no possibility of compliance because the vast amount of information that's being requested cannot possibly be even annotated, let alone delivered within the time slot permitted. And when you look at this further, as Blix did, senior U.S. administration officials then briefed reporters. And the Chronicle actually quotes high-level senior policymakers speaking on condition of anonymity that if any single disclosure that the Iraqis provide doesn't correspond or fails to match information that the U.S. intelligence agencies already have been presenting, the attack will follow.
Now, these resolutions from the United Nations, the concept of material breach of past Security Council resolutions will, quote, allow the U.S. to attack Baghdad at any time. The U.N. inspectors can inspect any site in the country, and this includes the presidential palaces, the government centers, and then declare them as exclusion zones from which no Iraqi can leave or enter, and in which all ground, auto, and aerial movement is forbidden. Inspectors can then go into the presidential palace or government center or private residences and confiscate anything from any of these sites that they see fit. Now, they can also take out any Iraqi official from the country together with their families in order to interrogate them.
And there is no possibility of resistance without triggering an attack. Iraq is forbidden to interfere in any fashion, and it even states that any member state which is taking action in Iraq, including military action in the no-fly zones, cannot be resisted. So the U.S. and British attack planes that bomb Iraqi military bases and infrastructure are given a green light to continue this with no allowance of any response from Iraq without then allowing the full-scale war to ensue. It's simply a document providing for the war that's already on the books. They're signing on. It's cynical. It's a cover operation. The UN is simply a fig leaf for U.S. aggression in Iraq.
Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen are co-hosts of Taking Aim, which airs on Pacific Station WBAI in New York. KPFT programmer and host of Earth 101, Hitaji Abdul Aziz, traveled recently to Western Australia to participate in an international conference on domestic violence. Herself the survivor of an abusive relationship, Aziz now focuses her energies on becoming a healer. This week on Earth 101, she discussed how she felt going to Australia to speak as an African-American woman on domestic violence coming from the most violent nation on Earth.
And so we put up the music and we've got Sweet Honey in Iraq playing in the background. And I'm in the back and I'm coming up there and we did do it. But what did I learn from the doing, from being in the present moment, from each city that I step forward in, from each person that I say hello and a goodbye, from each glance around the corner, from each glance or verbal communication, from each plane that we got on? We knew that we were going to care. We were going to care about people. We were going to show concern. We were going to speak up. We were going to find out who we were, just a little bit more of who we were as people, as women, as African-American women, as Americans, as people, as women who have come from violence, as women who seeking peace. We knew we had an obligation to be the best that we could be. It was a privilege. It's a privilege to be alive. It's a privilege to be in this country. It's a privilege to have this radio show. It's a privilege. I find it a privilege to being this life of this African-American woman life, this privilege to say, not in my name. And I knew as I watched them peep through those, you know, those clouds, you can't see anything when you're up in the air, and you know you're going real fast, but you feel like you're going real slow, and that's what life is all about. It's kind of like an airplane trip. And I knew, I said, I know I've got to say something about my government. I know I can't go all these many miles and talk about domestic violence, and coming from one of the most violent countries in the world, I've got to say something. And how will I say it? How will I say it to make sense? I've got to say, not in my name, the war, not in my name, Iraq, not in my name, Homeland Security. I had to expand. What does that mean in my name? When at the time, each mile I rode on this journey, there was another black young youth dying, not just in L.A., but all over the country. That is, the closer I got to Sydney, there was another Aborigine man taking his life. I knew that the closer I got to Western Australia, there was another black, brown, poor white man going into TDC. Someone was being executed. I wanted to say, I needed to say, I had to create a format to say, not in my name. So that moment came. And as I'm talking about domestic violence and the shelter programs and the refuge programs there and celebrating the 25th year, I had to bring up the impending war. I had to let them know that there were people over in this country that did not support the war. I had to let them know that it was difficult for us to get on TV and radio and news media, that we were kind of blacked out in this century. I had to let them know that the truth that they thought was the truth might not have been the truth. And I had to make it clear it was not in my name. That because my roots were American, and that I was an African-American woman, and that I had raised children in America, and that I had been here seven generations, that we didn't come over to this country as tourists. I had to tell them that we came over as slaves in a boat against our will, and it was not in my name. I had to make a stand. I had to verbally say something, because sometimes you can't verbally say something. You gotta wait for the moment. Sometimes you can't verbally tell all of your truth. You gotta figure out how to come through the back door. But it was that moment that I was privileged to say, not in my name. Not in my name. Not in my name. And I remembered, as I stepped up to the mic and I looked over that group of people, and looked like they was trying to figure, what the hell is she gonna say? Because the silence has got us in attention. The music has brought us to the front of the room. These people are different. Some of them looked at me like I hadn't, they were saying, I've never met an African-American woman. The Aborigine women were saying, she's not Aborigine, but she is part of us. We can feel it. We can sense it. We know that we know. It's so hard walking with integrity. It's so hard sometimes telling the truth. It is hard when you fall down and figuring out how to get up. It's hard. It's not easy. We come together on common ground. We talk about uncomfortable things. We talk about oppression. We talk about the left and the right. We talk about our president. We talk about what we don't hear on the national news. We talk about the national character of this country. We talk and we learn and we share and we bring to the table something that we can all take away and use. We can nibble on it. We can drink it. We can smell it. We can consume it. We can experience. We let it become a part of us so that we can walk away from this program becoming a better person, a better man, a better woman, a better mother, a better father, a brother, a sister, a better earth person. Common ground.
Hitaji Abdul Aziz. This piece was produced by Shannon at Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston. You're listening to Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a minute.